guys. Welcome back. We're at the Let's Everybody Get Settled. Thank you all again for coming. This is, and now we're ready for the main event. I'm going to keep this very brief because I don't want to cut into Dr. Kroll's time. But it's my absolute pleasure to invite our distinguished speaker today, Dr. Judy Kroll. Dr. Judy Kroll is one of the founding people in the study of bilingualism and was doing this work when people weren't doing it, right? And now it's very popular and it's really taken off. And it's really great to have her here. She's just some things I learned about Dr. Kroll in chatting with her today. She got her bachelor's degrees at NYU, as did I. She got her PhD at Brandeis. I did a postdoc there. and she lived in her formative years in Brooklyn. So did I. So I'm thrilled to learn all these things about her. Dr. Kroll is a distinguished professor of psychology, linguistics, and women's studies at Penn State University. And one of the other outstanding things about Dr. Kroll's work, aside from her stellar bilingualism research, is the fact that she's one of the founding organizers of the Women in Cognitive Science group, which is a very important group that has meetings associated with the big meetings in experimental psychology and cognitive science. And this is very important work. So in addition to her scholarly research, she's really doing a lot for our field professionally and students who are coming up and this sort of thing. So without further ado, I want to welcome Dr. Judith Kroll.
Yeah, this is a very, very hard act to follow today. I just want to start by just thanking Deborah and all of you for the delay of this event. My mother was dying last March, and I couldn't be here, and I fully expected this event to go on without me, and I think that it would have been perfectly appropriate. So when she told me that it was going to be delayed, I was very touched and really appreciate very much being able to be here today and to really share in all of these wonderful presentations. This talk is a little bit today, a little different than going and giving a talk cold, where this is a little bit like preaching to the choir. And there are many, many issues that came up in things that have been said already today that are interesting and complex. We're at a very interesting point in this research program overall. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try as best I can to go relatively quickly over the parts of the background that we've already reviewed in some detail today. They say that repetition priming is a good thing, makes us feel competent, so you should really be able to experience that at every level of cognition and brain function to which you have access. And then I really want to try to focus on some new research that we've been doing that's more focused on language processing than on directly on the cognitive consequences. And the question that I really want to keep in mind is really how what bilinguals do with language may produce some of these effects that we've been talking about today. So I just want to start by acknowledging many, many people over a very long period of time who have been very generous collaborators both within my lab and elsewhere, and particularly when you live in central Pennsylvania, hearing all of you talk about Montreal over and over again is very irritating if you live in central Pennsylvania, which is not the mecca of bilingualism. But it has a silver lining, because when you're here in Montreal, you really don't have to go anywhere else to do your research. When you live in central Pennsylvania, you have your ticket written to go anywhere in the world, because you really need to rely on the generosity of your collaborators, and generating those collaborations turns out to have many very, very special features. And one of the things I'll just mention is that at Penn State, we have begun to develop an international research network, which is now supported by a PIER grant from NSF. Jeanette is one of the co-PIs me and with Julie Ducius at Penn State, and with a group of colleagues, and we have a group of students who are here today. And this is allowing us to send our students abroad to do research and to develop collaborations that really exploit the particular context and forms of bilingualism in different places in the world. Okay, well, in the preaching to the choir context here in Montreal, it's not that surprising to say that more people in the world are bilingual than not. In State College, Pennsylvania, that is a surprising comment to make. But what we do know is that until relatively recently, most of the research on language and cognition examined primarily monolingual speakers, and primarily monolingual speakers of English. And that situation has changed radically. Witness all of you here, and all you need to do is a very quick skim of Web of Science to see the increase in the number of publications on second language learning and bilingualism, and it's really not an exaggeration to say that there's been an explosion of research on this topic. Okay, so what do we know? And this is really something that we've already, you've already heard in numbers of different forms this afternoon. We know that the current research shows that both languages are active. And they're active regardless of whether the bilingual intends to use only one. And that parallel activity is hypothesized to produce competition. Skilled bilinguals, however, rarely suffer very much from that competition. Now, there are various there have been various comments made during the talks this afternoon about Golan's weaker link hypothesis and about the idea that there may be some costs associated with bilingualism. But bilingualism produces relatively few costs compared to what it might. And the research on code switching that Jeanette mentioned is really perhaps the most stunning example that bilinguals, on one hand, seem to have both languages active, and at the other side of things, don't randomly make errors of language. We see very few errors of language in skilled bilinguals, and at the same time, it's possible to code switch with others who are similarly bilingual, suggesting that there is a very well-developed mechanism of cognitive control. Now, the hypothesis that we've been focused on for the last couple of hours is this idea that a life of resolving this kind of competition may, in fact, result in a set of benefits or positive consequences for both cognition and the brain. And the question is really, how does that happen? So the phrase that I've coined and that's been picked up in the sort of discourse is that the bilingual is a mental juggler. So the idea is that we see both languages active. But the thing that's interesting about this is just a hypothetical Dutch English speaker, with no offense to anyone who's a Dutch English speaker. And that Dutch English speaker is trying to say something very simple, which is just to name this object, which is one of the most common objects next to a glass of milk in the Netherlands, which is a bicycle, and the word for bike in Dutch is fiets. And the question is, how does a bilingual ever produce words in the language that's their less dominant language? Now, what we know is that parallel activation occurs in reading, in the experiments that Deborah talked about earlier. It occurs in listening. And very counterintuitively, it occurs in speaking. Because in speaking, you shouldn't have this kind of problem, because it should be under your own control. If you can't control what you're going to say, you're in very big trouble. And yet what we see repeated evidence that bilinguals have words on the tip of their tongue. They may not actually produce them, but they have words on the tip of their tongue in the language they do not intend to speak. And one question we want to ask is, how is that controlled? Now, I want to add, we'll come back to this, but the idea that it's not just people who are learning a second language. So it's not that surprising to think that if you're learning a second language, the first language is active and you see intrusions from it. But that it's also for people who are highly skilled bilinguals. And most of the experiments that I'm going to talk about today are with highly skilled, highly proficient bilinguals. And very counterintuitively, it's not just for the second language. It's also for the native language. And one of the observations and one of the sort of bottom lines that I want to come back to at the very end is the idea that the biggest and most striking changes that we see in bilingual performance may take place in the native language, that we once thought the native language was privileged. And really sort of impenetrable. And what we see repeatedly are effects on the native language of proficiency in the second language. So this is the part that I'm going to try to run through very, very quickly. But of course, we've been talking about the idea that the consequence of all of this parallel activity may be a set of benefits. And the kinds of benefits that have been discussed and have been reviewed this afternoon are that bilinguals may be better at ignoring irrelevant information, resolving conflict among competing alternatives, minimizing the costs that are associated with task switching, and that all of that may or may not, depending upon the evidence that you want to take as the bottom line, reveal some benefit. All you need to do is sample the media, and if you work on any of these topics, this is it's a little bit of a playing with fire phenomenon where people are very, very interested in what these effects really might be. And we know that I have a little bit of Ellen Bialystok's work, which we've heard the critique of just a few minutes ago. And the claim, of course, is that bilingualism provides protection against normal declines in aging. Bilingualism provides a set of benefits for young bilingual children. And the recent research, although it's very, very, very mixed in terms of the nature of the evidence, suggests that there may be benefits to young adult bilinguals as well. And the kinds of tasks that we've already seen illustrated today are tasks like the Simon task, where we look at the very simple sort of non-linguistic conflict resolution. And what we see is that bilinguals over the lifespan, these are data from Bialystok and colleagues in 2004, what we see is that over the lifespan, people begin to suffer cognitive decline. We're not going to talk about the age at which that happens. We'll just let that be out there. But what you see is that the yellow line is steeper than the red line. And the claim here, of course, is that bilinguals, who are the red people here, are better than the yellow people, who are the monolinguals. And so the monolinguals suffer the consequences of conflict in a task like the Simon task, or so it's claimed from this sort of study. And then we see, in keeping with the kind of studies that Denise was talking about, that you see some evidence for structural changes in the brain as well that seem to result from bilingualism. Very recent, this is an old example from research by McKelley looking at gray matter density in the brains of individuals who differ in their age of acquisition and proficiency in the second language. Very recently, Jubinava Tulebi published a paper with colleagues looking at the tuning of the ACC in bilinguals versus monolinguals for conflict resolution, claiming that bilinguals are more efficient at resolving conflict than monolinguals, and that can be seen in a pattern of brain activity that's more consistent with highly skilled performance than for monolinguals. So the question that I want to focus on today is really to turn this on its side, and there clearly are a set of very complicated, interesting, and challenging questions about what the cognitive consequences of bilingualism are, what the consequences are for brain structure and function. But the question that we need to answer is, what is it about the way bilinguals juggle the two languages that might underlie any of these results? What is it that bilinguals do with the two languages that might be special? Most of the evidence to date is largely correlational. So there's very little evidence that really is able to say there's this aspect of language processing that maps on in a very clear way to this aspect of cognitive or brain function. One hypothesis, and it's a hypothesis that's been put forward by a number of different groups, is that what's special in what bilinguals do involves speaking, and that speaking is a critical skill relative to language comprehension. Now, it may turn out that learning to process sentences that are ambiguous in your two languages, or where you have grammatical conflict across two languages, which is an issue that came up earlier in discussion, may be really crucial. But the argument that's been made is that when you speak one language only, you have to make a choice. And there may be something crucial about making that choice that then creates at least some subset of the benefits that have been observed. So the question that I want to ask is, how is cross-language competition resolved? And there are two general alternatives that have been considered, or two families of alternatives that have been considered in the literature. One is the idea that bilinguals get very good. They develop skill at paying attention to just the right cues that tell you language A is in play, language B is in play. You know what things look like, you know where to look, you know what to listen to. In the work we heard presented earlier today about crib bilinguals and bilingual babies, there's a lot of suggestion that babies exposed to two languages from birth are very, very good at picking up the cues that signal exactly how to divide their world into two. And certainly the work on switching in young bilingual children suggests that their children are very sensitive to those kinds of cues. An alternative is that adult bilinguals don't do that at all, that they can't do that, that for some reason a thousand flowers bloom whenever they're intending to speak even one language only. But that what they do learn to do is they learn to later inhibit the language not in use, or to attenuate the activation of the language not in use. And so one possibility is that there is an early attentional mechanism. Another possibility is that there's a late selection mechanism. And of course, both of these alternatives may work together. Either might, in theory, produce the kinds of cognitive consequences that have been reported for bilinguals. So the idea is that this juggling skill in speaking may be what's really crucial. We examine just a sort of generic model of speech production. This is taking the Dutch bicycle for a moment and just asking the question of how it is we come to say this name of this picture, in this case in English rather than in Dutch, and all of the sort of typical models of bilingual speech production are really modeled on the monolingual models that have been proposed by people like Willem Leveld and colleagues. And so the idea is that you have a set of stages where you need to understand what this object is, what it means. You need to have a set of alternative words that you might assign to those meanings, and then you need to encode those words into the phonology that's going to allow you to articulate eventually the name of the object. At some level, up here, you have this language cue. The proposal in the literature is that the language cue is operating at a conceptual level. So we think about it the same way you have the intention to name this object, to name this the idea you have of the bicycle. You have the intention to speak English and not Dutch. And the question is, how does that language cue function? Well, my picture of a Dutch bicycle with pretty flowers, which I don't know whether you see those in Montreal, but you wouldn't see that in State College. And you might argue that if you have some information that can really cue you in to the language that you're speaking and that tells you you're in the Dutch environment and this is more likely that it's going to be a fiets than a bicycle, and so you should really, really be able to then selectively weight the language that you want to speak, we can ask the question, can bilinguals utilize the information in cues that may be available conceptually, perceptually, linguistically in their environment to really draw their attention to the language they want to speak? Some models of bilingual production claim, yes, that bilinguals can do that. And this mental firewall that I have right down the middle, is one such idea. This is an idea that's put forward by people like Albert Costa and Barcelona and colleagues, where their idea is that bilinguals can't prevent activation of both languages. So you have alternatives in both languages that become active. But what they can do, according to this idea, is that they can erect a kind of mental firewall that says it doesn't matter if you have fire on the wrong side of the wall. If I'm going to speak, in this case, English and not Dutch, then what I can do is there can be all kinds of activation on the Dutch side of the model. But those activated candidates on the Dutch side of the model are not going to be considered as candidates for selection in production. And so the idea is that you have a model where you have things active, but you only select from one side. If such a model were to work, you need to then have a lot of faith in the way bilinguals use this language cue. You have to be able to come up with a way of establishing this mental firewall. So our research strategy has been to first look for the cues that bilinguals might use to separate their world in two, ask what those cues might be and how they might function, and then in the absence of finding those cues, asking more directly, just what is the evidence for attenuation or inhibition of the language not in use? And so the idea here is that bilinguals might be able to exploit information, as I said a moment ago. That information might take a variety of forms. It might be conceptual. You might know you're in a French-speaking environment or a Dutch-speaking environment. It might be perceptual. It might be linguistic. And so if you see a picture of an object like this one, this could be either a bike or a feet. It's a dictionary-like line drawing of the sort that experimental psychologists love to use in experiments. However, if you see a picture like the one that I've shown you, it's much more likely to be a feet than a bike. And if you see this picture, it's even more likely to be a feet than a bike. And this picture is definitely Dutch. Now, the question is, can bilinguals exploit cues to language status? And I think Deborah Jarrett has some recent evidence that suggests that maybe they can. And maybe in discussion, Deborah, you can talk a bit about that. But in the work that we've done, we find that cues to the language in play are not easily exploited. We find that when you compare same script versus different script bilinguals, so Spanish-English bilinguals versus Japanese-English bilinguals, if you're Japanese-English bilingual and you're confronted with a word in English, it can't be Japanese. It's in your face. Yet, it's not that script doesn't have an effect, but script does not seem to function in this way. Bilinguals, you don't see the absence of activation of the language not in use simply by virtue of the fact that you have two different languages that differ in script. Likewise, and even perhaps more striking example, if you examine performance by bimodal bilinguals, so individuals who are hearing individuals but who sign, so one of their languages is sign language and another language is a spoken language, they also show activation of both languages even when intending to use one language alone. So somehow the cues associated with how those languages differ is not sufficient to turn off the language not in use. And in some ways, in the example that Deborah mentioned this earlier in her presentation, in these experiments that look at what happens when you take language ambiguous words like cognates and homographs and put them in sentence context, you would think if you're reading sentences in one language alone over and over and over again in an experiment, why should you activate both meanings, both alternatives of an ambiguous word? And yet what we find is that it's very, very difficult to get rid of those cross-language effects, even when the readers have a great deal of information about what they're going to encounter. So our research strategy, we haven't given up on the idea of looking for cues, but it seemed like not the most profitable direction. And so we began to look at how it might be that bilinguals really modulate their production in the absence of the ability to decide in advance which language they're going to speak. Now, and we've already spoken this afternoon about a number of different approaches to looking at bilingual production. A general approach has been to use tasks that require that bilinguals speak both languages, and then to have them either switch or not, and ask the question of how using the two languages together imposes costs that might not be seen when they're using one language alone, and ask whether those costs are differential for the first or the second language. And we see that in the example of the language switching that's been described earlier this afternoon. This is from an experiment we did a number of years ago where we asked Dutch-English bilinguals to name pictures of objects, but we didn't tell them in the critical condition which language they were going to speak. And then what we did is we cued them with a tone. And so if you hear a high tone in this experiment, you would have to name this object in English. If you hear a low tone, you would have to name it in Dutch. It's a little bit of a cruel trick, right? Because you don't know, it's not, people don't like being in a situation where they have this kind of uncertainty. And what we then did is we varied the time course over which the tone was presented. So either it came right away, relieve you of your pain, or you had to wait until for a while before you got the tone and knew which language to speak. In the comparison conditions, we told people right away, you're always going to speak English, you're always going to speak Dutch. But they still got a cue, and so in the pure condition, you might hear a high tone and have to say bike. If you got a low tone, instead of saying the word in Dutch, you would just say no. Okay, so you have mixed and blocked conditions. And what we find is very similar to what we find in language switching. In language switching, you have a result that I think Jeanette reviewed in her talk, where you see that there is differential cost to the native language when you switch. So when the L1 follows the L2, responses are longer. And the explanation that was initially given for that result was that, well, the native language or the dominant language is active when bilingual speakers prepare to speak the second language. Therefore, the native language is going to have to be suppressed in some way. And if on the next trial I ask you to speak the native language, it's been down and you now need to bring it back up to be able to use it. In the language mixing condition, we find something very similar. In the language mixing condition, there are a couple of interesting results. So what's plotted here is simply the time to name pictures as a function of whether you're naming in the L1 or L2. And as a function of whether it's mixed or blocked. And what we find in this behavioral study is that, first of all, for the L2 shown on the right, you can see that there's absolutely no difference in L2 depending upon whether it's mixed or blocked. So when these Dutch-English bilinguals are highly proficient, they're dominant in Dutch, but they're highly proficient in English. So when they get ready to speak English, which is their L2, it doesn't matter whether you deliberately force the Dutch to be active or not. It seems to be active anyway and have very little consequence. However, for the L1, in the condition where you, in this case, they're naming in Dutch, you see a very large cost associated with forcing the second language to be active at the same time or to be a possible response. And what happens that's very curious in this case is, do you see how the black bar for L1 is longer than the black bar for L2? And so what we see is that these Dutch-English bilinguals who are dominant in Dutch are now slower to speak Dutch than English under these conditions. They're slower in their L1 than their L2. And to us, these results look a lot like inhibition. And the question then is whether we can find evidence that convinces us that this is really inhibition of the native language, and if so, at what level, or whether this is simply some kind of attenuation that is a modulation of performance that's resulting for some other reason. And the approach that we've taken is actually very similar to the approach that Natalie described earlier, looking at the cognitive consequences of bilingualism. And we've taken this to looking at bilingual production. And so we've used ERPs to look at the earliest stages of speech planning. We've used reaction times and accuracy to look at the behavioral outcomes of those processes. And then we've looked at two other measures. One is a late measure of production to look at articulation, which is related to some of the work that's going on in Deborah's lab. So we've looked at acoustic measures of produced speech under conditions where we think bilinguals are having to resolve competition across the two languages. And most recently, we have dipped our toes into the fMRI ocean. And I say that with some caution. But we have begun to look at the consequences of these speech planning events by looking at imaging as well. So I'm going to talk a bit about each of those different approaches, and I will try to keep myself on time here. Okay, we've seen some of the behavioral evidence, and now I want to look at these early stages in ERPs. Until recently, ERPs were not a method of choice for people who are studying speech production because of all the issues about movement artifact. Those, we can talk in the discussion later if anyone wants to discuss this, but those issues have mostly been solved. And it is possible to do ERP research. And it's interesting because bilinguals are often a little bit slower to speak than monolinguals. And so there are fewer problems in doing a direct measures of ERP measures of language production in bilinguals than you might have thought in the past. And so we started with a very simple idea. This experiment, just this paper, just appeared in JML this year. And in this study, what we did is we simply had a set of Chinese English bilinguals, either name pictures in Chinese, their native language, or name pictures in English, their second language. And all we varied was which one they did first, whether they named the pictures in Chinese first or the pictures in English first. We had, within each block, we had two sub-blocks, so they would name two blocks of trials in one language and then two blocks of trials in the next language. And within each language, the actual pictures they named were the same. And so this is an example. The pictures were not actually presented in the same order. This is simply a limitation on my monolingual ability to use PowerPoint. They were the same pictures, but they actually occurred in different order. And so the question is, what would you expect if you name one set of pictures in one language and then you name the same set of pictures again in the other language? You should get priming. See the same picture, you see the same object, the same concepts, you should have priming. And what do we expect when we see priming? Well, what we expect in the ERPs, we would expect to see reduced negativity in the ERP pattern. And that is exactly what we find for the L2. And so the data on the right are for the L2. And what we see is the red is when the L2 came second, when it was in the primed position following the L1. What we see for L1 is exactly the opposite. And in fact, the results are, if anything, a bit larger. We find a pattern for L1 that is consistent with the inhibitory interpretation. We find the N2 that was talked about, or that Natalie talked about earlier, and of course there has been debate about how to interpret the N2 with respect to conflict resolution. But it's very clear that we see an N2 here in the associated with this inhibitory pattern. But the point is that if you look at these two, even if you know nothing about ERP research, and you look at these two graphs, you see we're getting the opposite results in the two languages. And one thing to note is that because there were the same pictures, there has to be repetition priming here. We know that from lots of other experiments that have been done. And so what that means is that whatever this inhibitory pattern is telling us, it's an underestimation of the true degree of inhibition. Because there's got to be some facilitation that's the priming that's mixed into the data. Okay, so what we then did is we said, well, maybe you get over it. Maybe the problem is maybe bilinguals have a problem when they speak their native language after they've spoken the second language, and then they just get over it. So you recover. So you have this momentary lapse where you're inhibiting like mad, and then you are just speaking the L1, the L1, the L1, and you just recover. And so what we did is we looked at these two blocks that were embedded within the set of blocks that followed L2. And what we found in the context of this experiment is that they didn't recover. So within, and we only did this experiment for four blocks because we had no idea that they wouldn't recover. We never predicted that they wouldn't recover. What this result suggests is that there is long-lasting inhibition of the native language following spoken production in the second language, and at least within the constraints of this experiment, it didn't go away very easily. And we thought that was surprising. So we moved on to then look at what happens. So we're looking here. This was telling us something about what's happening early. Now we wanted to know what was happening late. And so we began to look at acoustic measures of production, and the measure that we used was articulatory duration. So in most behavioral studies, where you look at naming, you can look at the onset of articulation as the typical measure that's reported. But you can also look at how long people speak. You can look at the duration of their spoken production. The assumption in much of the monolingual literature is that at the point where articulation begins, speech planning is done, that people plan, and then they execute the plan. What's interesting about bilinguals, of course, is that bilinguals may often have to speak before they're ready to speak, and they may not have complete phonology in the second language, and they may have to be producing and executing their speech plans when they're not complete. We've looked at this in a number of different contexts. It's notable that in most of these production models, you don't even have these late processes included. In fact, there are other models that look at that aspect of production. So the question is really how far into this planning process are we going to see these effects of the language not in use? And the paradigm that we used here was a paradigm where we, instead of just having one block and then another block, what we did is we had a paradigm where we had the first language, second language, first language, or second language, first, second. So we had an interpolated block in between, and that allowed us to look sort of before and after naming the L2 in the case when L1 came first, or vice versa, looking at interpolating L1 when L2 came first. So the question was, would there be an effect on duration? And we're going to look first at this L1, L2, L1. And this is a preliminary data from a study where the data were collected in the context of an ERP study where we did digital recordings of the produced speech. And what we found is that these are Chinese-English bilinguals, that when they speak Chinese following English, the articulatory duration is significantly longer. Okay, so again, a pattern that looks inhibitory. However, to argue that there's inhibition of the L1, we need to demonstrate, like the ERP and RT results, that there are no corresponding effects in the L2. Because this might be something, maybe people just get slow as they process things in this kind of experiment. And so we then looked at the L2 and we find no effect in the L2. So what this suggests is it suggests that the results that we see for speaking the L1 following the L2 are genuinely reflecting a process of inhibiting the L1. We have interference in the L1 after the L2 is spoken. Now, when we first presented these results, we were criticized on the grounds that that's all very nice, but maybe it's not really inhibition because of bilingualism. Maybe it's really inhibition because it's hard to speak a second language. And when you speak a second language, you have to draw on all kinds of resources. And there are studies that look at both behavioral and brain responses to things like working memory demands in processing the second language. And so maybe what we have is a situation where we're just reflecting a sort of difficulty effect. And so we wanted to do some experiments to see whether we could rule this out. We thought it was unlikely, but we thought we better look at this in a bit more detail. And so what we did is we came up with the following experiment. We said, what if a group of our pathetic monolinguals in central Pennsylvania were invited to the lab to name these pictures in English only? So you name the pictures in English in block one, you name pictures in English in block two, you name pictures of English in block three. The twist in the experiment is in the interpolated block, we rotate the objects. And so you never know the orientation in which you're going to see the object. There are experiments that show that when you have to name an object that is in a non-canonical presentation, that you have to mentally rotate it in your head to bring it into view, and that takes you longer. It's harder to do. It's going to slow down production. And so the question is, would we get the same spillover effect for monolinguals? Could we simulate the bilingual effect in monolinguals by having this kind of interpolation? Does it take longer to name it, these rotated objects? Absolutely. These are the reaction times to name the rotated objects relative to an object in its canonical view. Does it produce a spillover effect? No. So the argument that we want to make, based on it's not the only control experiment that one could do, but the at least on first pass, it suggests that the effects that we're seeing for the bilinguals are really due to their bilingualism and to processes that are engaged by using the second language, not simply because processing a second language itself is difficult. And a number of other labs have looked at these articulatory effects. So the question that we then wanted to look at was whether or not there's fMRI evidence that might be consistent with this mounting evidence that we have now for inhibition of the native language. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail on all of this, but there's some very nice work by Jubin Abutalebi and David Green mapping out a framework for looking at the different areas of the brain that seem to be involved in cognitive control, specifically during bilingual speech production, and looking at the way in which those areas are differentially activated when bilinguals have to choose between languages rather than simply perform another task that involves choice within language. In one study that appeared in 2011, we looked again at Chinese-English bilinguals naming pictures, very similar to the ERP study. The difference was that we had them name pictures in L1, name pictures in L2, or vice versa, and then everyone named a set of mixed pictures, mixed language conditions at the very end of the experiment. And the main result, to be quick about it, was simply that we found different patterns of brain activation when we compared the blocking of one language to the other versus when we compared the blocked and mixed language. And the argument we made in this paper, which I do not want to go to the wall on because I'm not sure that it's the right argument, but it was a first first attempt to try to understand the idea that there might be different types of inhibition, is that we argued that the comparison of the blocked naming would tell us something about global inhibitory effects, whereas the comparison of block versus mix would tell us something about local inhibitory effects. And what we found is we found evidence for ACC-SMA activity in the comparison of the blocked and mixed, whereas we found evidence for the dorsal left frontal gyrus and parietal cortex in the global comparison of the blocking effect. I'm not sure that argument is right, but what's crucial is that they're different patterns, is that these two effects, each of which seem to produce inhibition, are producing different types of inhibition. And so it got us very interested in the question of how we could begin to unpack what those different components of inhibition might look like. And one thing that was very clear to us is that this ERP study I told you about suggested that inhibition lasted for longer than we expected it to. But we didn't really have a theory about how long it should last. If you're immersed in here in Montreal for 2 weeks, and then you go home, are you forever ruined by having been here for 2 weeks? No, I'm serious. I mean, how long does it last? Something happens, and the system is extremely flexible. But we need to have an underlying theory about when this is going to happen. Likewise, we need to say something about the scope of inhibition. So what's being inhibited? The words that you speak? Particular semantic categories. We know that there's an interesting literature, patient literature, on category-specific impairments. Well, maybe bilinguals have something similar. Maybe bilinguals are, you know, can inhibit all the fruits and vegetables and everything else is ready to go. Or maybe there's inhibition of the entire language. And so in an experiment that Eleanor Rossi, who's here somewhere, has been leading. We have been collecting fMRI data on conditions that we think will begin to allow us to say something about the time course and scope of inhibitory processes. And so what we've done in this experiment is we've had bilinguals named pictures. These are English-Spanish bilinguals. And we designed the experiment so that they initially name a block of pictures in English, then they name pictures in Spanish, and then we put the Spanish away. And what we do differently than we've done in other experiments is we have them name English for a long time. We have them name 6 blocks of pictures in English at the end of the experiment. Okay, so this is a very long, boring experiment. We then have a group of monolinguals who do the same thing, but just in English alone. And here's the idea of the experiment. The idea is to try to figure out what it is that becomes inhibited. So here you have this picture that I actually took in a fruit market in Rome. These are some peaches and fruits and vegetables. Well, one possibility is that it's really the particular lexical item, that it's really something about the word that you've spoken. Another possibility is that it's the entire category. So somehow all the fruit, once you've spoken these fruit in your other language, that fruit then is suppressed in your native language. Or it's possible that it's really the entire language. And so what we did is we initially had them name in English, the bilinguals name pictures drawn from 3 semantic categories. The categories were not presented in a blocked form. The pictures were, exemplars were sampled from all of these different categories, and so they named animals, body parts, vegetables in English. Then we had them name a different set of pictures in Spanish. And the different set of pictures were intentionally drawn from other categories, and notice that they're all drawn from, these are all from inanimate, non-biological categories, clothing, kitchen items, and furniture. And one thought we've had about this is, can we create a mental firewall? Can you learn over the course of the experiment that those biological things are your English things and those non-biological things are your L2? And we weren't sure whether that would have any effect at all. But critically, what we did later on in these final 6 blocks of the experiment is they just spoke English. They just spoke their native language. And what we did is we sometimes showed them pictures they'd seen before and named in the L1. We sometimes showed them pictures that they had named in the L2. But we sometimes showed them new pictures. And the new pictures sometimes could be pictures from the old categories that they hadn't seen. So you might see an animal that you had not previously spoken in L1, or a kitchen item that you had not previously spoken in L2. And now you'd have to produce it in L1. Or you'd see items that were completely new and drawn from completely different categories that had not been seen before. And so the logic of the experiment was to simply ask, if we see effects that are consistent with this inhibitory hypothesis, will we see it across the board, or will we only see it for certain of these conditions? And if so, can we use that as a way of beginning to focus on what the scope of inhibition might be? And the idea of using these 6 blocks was to see how long it lasts. Now, I just want to say from the start that we haven't finished analyzing these fMRI data. And as I said, we've just begun to stick our toe into the fMRI ocean, and we've learned that it's relatively easy to collect data and very, very hard to analyze it. So we are still in the process of analyzing the data. The behavioral data for the bilinguals looked like they're much more accurate to name in L1 than L2, and it looked like there was a bit of a dip in the first set of blocks after the naming the L2, and that they begin to recover. We also see a little bit of a dip in the monolingual data, so it might just be a fatigue dip, and so we're not quite sure what the behavioral data show us. But the critical question is this question about scope, and the data, the fMRI data we have so far, allow us, at least at a global level, looking at all of the data from these last blocks in the experiment, to ask what happens. And what we see when we do these three comparisons is we see, it's not identical activation, but we see very similar activation both in pre-SMA and ACC in all of the comparisons. So what we do is we compare performance in the first two cases for the bilinguals. It's when they're naming pictures they've seen before. They've previously seen them in either L1 or L2. Now they're naming them in L1. The second comparison is when they're naming pictures they haven't seen before, but they're drawn from the same semantic categories they saw. And the final comparison is when they're naming brand new pictures that they haven't seen before. And clearly, we need to still be able to break this down over the time course, but our initial take on these data is that they are more similar than different. And they suggest that the scope of inhibition is broad. And that to the extent, and I refrain from using the word global easily because it sounds very dramatic, but it looks like the whole language is being inhibited. And that even when you see items that you hadn't seen before, that your L1 is showing the same pattern of activation. When we compare the bilinguals on the top with the monolinguals on the bottom, the monolinguals do not show these effects. And what's striking is that the monolinguals also got repetitions across these different categories. They just didn't have an L2. So it's very tempting, it's very preliminary, but it's very tempting to conclude that there indeed is something special about the activation that is being induced in bilingual speech and in making the choice between the two languages. Clearly, we need to complete the analysis and really see how this plays out over time and whether it's possible, for example, that there are separable lexical semantic whole language contributions that may have different time courses. And once we do the appropriate analyses, we should be able to determine that. It's also the case, there's a recent study in Cortex, I think, by Jones and colleagues, showing that monolinguals sometimes do not show the same patterns of activation in the native language in naming pictures as bilinguals. And so we have to also rule out the idea that this is really a bilingual-monolingual difference, and ideally we'll be able to look at bilinguals just speaking their native language and being able to show the same kind of comparison. As a first step, it converges very nicely with the ERP data, with the acoustic data, and with the behavioral data in suggesting that when bilinguals speak their L2, there is some inhibition of the L1. Okay, very briefly, I have about 10 minutes left, I think. Okay, so I just want to return to a study that we published a while ago. It's a behavioral study. But looking at the question of how these kinds of inhibitory effects might happen in the real world, and of course one context in which they happen is when an individual is immersed in the second language environment. And this is a study that was published in Psych Science in 2009, where we looked at a group of college students who were in Salamanca, Spain for a semester. And what's striking about that is, I mean, a semester of study abroad is really not much. And these are people who are learners. So these are people who are very dominant in their native language. And we did a variety of tasks with these people, and we compared a group of immersed learners with a group of classroom learners who were matched to them in every which way we could think of. We tried, when they weren't matched, to err in the direction of having the classroom learners be more proficient than the immersed learners. Okay. And what we found is in both comprehension and production tasks, there was evidence of suppression or inhibition of the L1. I'm just going to tell you really quickly about the results from the production task. We used a verbal fluency task that, of course, has been used a lot in the recent literature and also in the clinical literature, where people are asked to simply generate as many exemplars of a category as they can think of, and we use 30 seconds. People sometimes use a minute, and we only used a semantic verbal fluency task. What's nice about the task in studying L2 learners is that it's under their control. So unlike presenting them with a picture that they may not know the name of in their L2, here they can really generate, you can generate whatever you do know. And here's what we found. What we found is if you look at the data, first of all, you see all the English is higher than the Spanish. These are learners. These are intermediate learners of Spanish who are dominant in English as their native language. So that's not a big surprise. If you look at the data on the right, you see the red bar is higher than the black bar. The immersed learners are doing better than the classroom learners in Spanish. And that's a good thing. If you're paying to have your child go abroad for a semester, you get something back from that investment. But here's the main result. The main result is on the left in English. The immersed learners are suppressed in their verbal fluency in English. And it's very striking. They produce less in English, even though English is their native and dominant language. So we asked the question, we then, after this study, and we published a study and reported the number of exemplars that were produced. But we really wanted to dig into these data. These are very rich data. We had digital recordings of the production, and so we embarked on a very masochistic research project where we spent about a year doing a secondary analysis of the acoustics of what they produced. And of course, everybody says something different, so it's not a trivial thing to do. So the first question was, Do they recover from this apparent inhibition when they continue to speak L1? This is simply the response latency to produce the first response in a verbal fluency sequence. And what you can see is that the immersed learners are much slower to begin to speak English than the classroom learners. And so we said, fine, maybe it's just the first couple words that come out, and then once you go, you're back in gear again. And what we found is basically they don't recover. What we found is that this is an analysis where we look at, we broke the 30 seconds up into bins, and so we have 6 5-second bins, and we simply ask how much do they produce every 5 seconds. And what you see in English, it's a very subtle effect, and it should be a subtle effect because it's their native language. What you see is that they are producing, the red is the classroom learners, the black are the immersed learners, and what you see is the immersed are consistently producing less than the classroom learners in English throughout the entire time course. It's true through the entire sequence of different categories we ask them to generate, and it's true when we look at other aspects of the acoustics. So we can look at the duration, at the inter-response interval between words, and they're also slower to produce the next word in English. So all of the evidence points to the idea that there is suppression of the L1, and of course we don't know with these immersed learners, once they return into their English-dominant environment, how long that lasts, and it's a question that will obviously be interesting to investigate. Okay, so to sum up, one of the points that I want you to take away, this is sort of a joke, but the native language is not the Rock of Gibraltar. We have the native language is always taking a hit in these experiments. And one of the things that we've been thinking about a lot these days is just what this effect on the L1 really, really tells us about bilingualism. We think that negotiating these consequences for the L1 may in fact turn out to be a very critical aspect of these cognitive consequences that we've been debating all afternoon. And to my knowledge, there's been very little attempt to really try to get a handle on just how much of a cost a particular individual suffers in their L1 and to what extent that cost may eventually map onto these cognitive benefits that have been claimed. I just want to say very briefly, I don't have time to go into it today, but there is evidence not just at the word level. So we've all been talking a lot about words, but there's evidence at the grammar. Our colleague at Penn State, Julie Ducias, has done these beautiful studies of relative clause attachment strategies showing that native Spanish speakers who've been immersed in English for a while but haven't attrited it, they have kept their Spanish. But you begin to look at preferences and parsing in the native language, and they begin to parse Spanish as if it were English. So they begin to prefer the L2 preferences in the L1 environment. And across the literature, we're beginning to see evidence that all of these effects of the L2 on the L1 are really quite pervasive. One of the speculations about this is that it's really because the neural evidence suggests that the L1 and the L2 really are sitting there in the same bedroom together. And so they're sharing that space, and the way that that is negotiated may really eventually tell us something about the underlying source of these consequences, both for behavior and for the brain. So what I want to argue is that when bilinguals prepare to speak their second language, there is activation of the first language, and that activation is handled by a process that looks to us to be inhibitory. The word inhibition until recently, at least in the behavioral literature, has been something of a dirty word, and people try very hard to come up with explanations that don't require inhibition. Saying that there's inhibition in language processing does not mean there's inhibition in cognitive processing. It means that there may be spillover, there may be consequences of that process that may map on to differential activation cognitively and neurally. But we see it everywhere we look. We see it in the earliest stages of speech planning and the ERPs. We see it in the behavior. We see it in the fMRI data, and we see it in these very late measures, acoustic measures of produced speech. We also see it in these immersed learners. And we think that understanding the nature of that cost to the L1 is really going to be very crucial in understanding eventually what it means what it means to be bilingual, and what it means when we see effects of language immersion, when we see effects of language attrition. There's a rich literature that we haven't touched on today on bilingual aphasia. And so when there's damage to the brain, aphasia results, what sort of inhibitory control is affected. And so a critical the question that we want to ask is, how is it that these effects that we've identified in language processing may eventually map onto their respective cognitive and neural consequences? We don't think there's going to be a one-to-one mapping, and we don't think that a simple componential analysis is going to get us there either, but it's very clear we need to begin to map out the scope of these phenomena. I want to end with everyone. It's been a very long, interesting afternoon. I know that we want to have a little bit of time for discussion. But I want to say that one thing that's really crucial, and I know that I'm preaching to the choir, so I don't really need to preach, but we wouldn't know any of this if we studied monolinguals only. And I know it seems like an idiotic thing to say to people in Montreal, but elsewhere in the world, in the academic circles that we move in, it's not been obvious to people until relatively recently that that's true. And so regardless of whether we think we understand how all of this works or not, I think that it's very clear that bilingualism provides a very, very rich context in which we need to really examine very basic assumptions about language development, about what we mean by what a native language might be, and what that means for the sort of plasticity associated with adult learning. So I want to end with an example, just to leave you with something lighter, that there are still some adults who simply are not that flexible. This is an example of an American in Paris who has no lexicon, no grammar, and absolutely no inhibitory control. Thank you.
So in the interest of being flexible, I was just told that there's a class at 6 o'clock in here. So why don't we'll just open it up for questions, and we'll have 10 minutes or less. Or for Judy as well.
Thank you so much for such a thought-provoking talk. I particularly enjoy the idea of different types of inhibition, and I wanted to ask you, like the inhibition that you saw in a verbal fluency task was actually like a self-determined, self-paced inhibition. We know that maybe different areas in the brain than when you have to do it inhibit. In a task that is determined by, like, in your naming task, you hear a tone, and we know that, like, the work of Michael Petridis and other people here, they have showed that there are different differences in the brain in these areas, different areas of the brain. Is this something that you think may change with bilingualism? Is it something that you think?
Change in what sense? You mean over the development of proficiency or over time?
Yes.
Or?
Like when we talk about inhibition, I mean, is it something that you think one should distinguish? Is it something that we may, maybe bilingualism, I don't know, trains one type or trains more one or the other type? I don't know. I mean, is it something?
Yeah, I think there may be contexts that may be more likely to induce inhibition. I think that there are certainly proficiency differences, although it's striking that we have a lot of data from people who are relatively proficient and still show these effects. I think that there may be individual differences in along the lines of the different individual difference measures that other people have mentioned today that we haven't even begun to look at. So some people may be more susceptible to inhibition than others. And some people may be better able to inhibit more quickly. We also know that there is evidence in the comprehension literature for inhibition that seems to be relatively short-lived, and we don't know whether there's any relationship between what we see in comprehension and what we see in production. So I have no doubt that there are other factors that are you know, related to the presence and the duration and potentially the scope of these effects. I think the main point of what I wanted to say is that we weren't initially looking for this. We didn't exactly think this was what was going to happen, and so we've been surprised by the convergence across these different different measures.
A lot more time. It's whatever I have to say would either be trivial or would take a lot more time than we have at our disposal, given that we're late. So we'll wait for it.
Yeah, I feel much the same way. There are a couple of ideas that were prompted by what I heard today. It was really a fabulous workshop. If you like, I'll just summarize these and take one minute perhaps, and maybe it'll stimulate some questions. This whole idea of looking at bilingualism across the lifespan, I think, is something relatively new, and it was a good way to bring together all the speakers who look at bilingualism at different ages. But it would be interesting, and something that we're starting to talk about at Concordia, too, a lot now, is what is a lifespan perspective on bilingualism? Because what we heard today were stories about bilingualism at different points in the lifespan, but nothing that kind of really brought it all together. So that's just something to think about. Another one is that quite a few people mentioned the social dimension of communication here. But again, it would be interesting to study much more how the social dimension actually interacts with all of this cognitive development. And one of the things about the social issues that we might want to think about is how a person sees the language situating them in a social context will open or close opportunities to practice the language and use it, and that can have an impact on the way they develop. So there could be some really complex interactions here if we go into the social dimension. The notion of attention was talked about a lot, and this is really exciting work that you were telling us about today, Judy. Perhaps the notion of attention, though, should also be broadened and go beyond simply the idea of do we suppress or stop one language from intruding on the other language. We talked a little bit about the grammatical issues in language. You can one way you can think about grammar is to think about the grammar of a language providing you with ways of pointing your attention to different words in the sentence, so the relationships between words. And that perhaps is another form of attention different from the just turning off or turning on a whole language. So it would be interesting to start exploring that. I think Natalie started to speak about that in her presentation. And then you had primed us with some questions that might go for discussion. And one topic which didn't come up at all but maybe is of interest to the center, you asked about music and language and the similarities. So I'll just throw some crazy ideas out there. We could ask, is there a bilingualism parallel in music? Not just in the sense that music is a communication system and has emotional aspects to it and expressive and so on, and even involves symbolic manipulation, but musicians who, let's say, play violin and viola have to use different fingerings and different way of playing to accomplish the same goals. Is that, in any of the senses that we heard about today, like having two languages? Is the skill of reading a treble clef and bass clef, which pianists do automatically, is that, again, a skill that is like being bilingual, having two orthographies or something like that? So maybe there are a lot of interesting questions that can be transposed into the music area as well, and vice versa. There might be really some interesting
interactions. And do you think that the analogy with music is different than with different sports that are similar on some dimensions? Or, I mean, is there anything really distinct about it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. It would be empirical issue. But what is, I think, special about music that may not be true about sports is that there's a lot of symbolic processing that goes on. especially in highly skilled, trained virtuoso performers, they have the whole idea of the structure of the music and the notations and so on. I don't know if that applies to sport in the same way. It may. Good question.
Normal brought up the idea of grammar being different from words, for example. And I think that one thing that came up several times is that we have to distinguish between controlled choices and switching in normal conversation. Switching in normal speech is the same as speaking sentences, grammar, but then when you ask to say it in Spanish if it's blue and in English if it's red, this is a good psychological experiment to see about control, but it has nothing to do about learning about grammar and in particular about language and in particular about switching, because when you switch in a normal switching environment, it's just as automatic as using a passive or an active just comes along. You don't have to control, you don't have... It's part of your language system, and it's totally implicit,
And I think that's what a lot of the recent evidence that's emerging on the psycholinguistic studies of code switching suggests, that the switch costs are actually quite small relative to these imposed switches in other contexts. I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay. I wish we could stay longer.
Yep.
Does anybody have any final words, or... Thank you so much. Before we go, I
just want to thank Judy and all our speakers, and especially my students, who really did a great job today. I have to call out Veronica Whitford in particular, and Lisa Cody, who's our center administrator, and all my students today did a fantastic job. So thank you so much. Okay. Thank you all
for
coming.
Steph.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Thank you.